Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
The Market Musings Podcast.
Well, hello everyone and welcome back to the Market Musings Podcast here from Stockbox, where today we're very excited to have our guest Dan Lane. He's from Robinhood. He's the UK's lead analyst and of course co-host, another Dan, the regular Dan on Stockbox, Dan Flynn. Dan Lane, welcome. How are you doing?
Thanks very much. Yes, doing very well. I'm glad to be here. Thanks very much both for having me.
No, it's really good to be speaking. We were very pleased when someone from your team sort of reached out and said you were perhaps interested in doing a bit of a podcast because, of course, many retail investors will know the Robinhood app. I don't use it myself personally, but it's a very easy way to sort of put money in the markets and see your portfolio change up or down. So it's really, really great to have a chat to you about what you're seeing in the markets and perhaps some of the things that we cover a lot on Stockbox, if there's any crossover or interest in some of the retail investors that are using your platform. And Dan's here as well to sort of, join in the conversation. I don't know if, Dan, if you're looking to get anything out of this particular, any things you really want to discuss?
Oh, we were just chatting before, and it's saying it's such an interesting time, both for the UK and globally. So looking forward to hearing what Dan has to say about where we should be looking.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting time, isn't it? Gosh, I mean, we can talk about that. But of course, gold doing extremely well, silver catching up as well. And we've got tariffs, we've got US government shutdowns, we've got cost of living crisis in the UK. And even here in the Netherlands, where I'm based, I'm starting to see that now for the first time. So we're in a bit of a strange environment. Markets are at all-time highs, but we can certainly get into some of those details. But Dan, I wonder if perhaps first of all, you can perhaps just give us a little bit of a history of yourself. I'd be quite keen to understand how you got into investing, what your sort of investing journey was like. Any, standout winners or indeed standout losers is always a good little story. And then perhaps just what led you to your role at Robinhood.
Yeah, sure. I mean, so my background was I was actually a teacher for a couple of years and did that classic move from teaching into investment management. and that was after meeting, my first employer was Fidelity. And I was there, met them, and they were fantastic and leading me through and basically teaching me all about the markets. But my first role was quite exciting for me. It was to go around the city and interview all kind of the big hitter fund managers. So in a calendar year, I would probably interview 50 of them, get a little nice little soundbite and an article and send it out to our investors. But what that meant was that at a young age, I got quite a good grounding in like 50 different styles. And, you're just learning for the first few years. And then, after a few years, you go, hang on, I chime more with this than that. And then you start to do your own thing. And after Fidelity, I went and led up content at a fintech, spent some time at a hedge fund. And now I'm at Robinhood, so I've got two institutional sides and two fintechs. So I feel like I can understand both worlds quite well.
Good. Well, you don't look too old at the moment. So you must have started pretty young, going around the city talking to people. But that's a great way to get an understanding, isn't it? That's kind of what me and Dan do. I mean, I interview lots of different CEOs, and Dan goes around talking to people and sort of, well, you wrote articles, didn't you? You did a lot of writing, Dan, didn't you, for publications?
Yeah, background was in asset management. So perhaps, Dan, we were talking to some of the same people back, 6 or 7 years ago.
So, Dan Lane, what was your first foray into not mining, but generally investing? I think I started in 2013. It's my first, started to put money into the markets. I'm just kind of guessing what stocks look good and not really having much success. And, you know, here we are sort of over 10 years later, and you think you're a bit better at it, but it's not, it doesn't seem to get any easier. But what was your sort of start of the journey like?
It's interesting looking back, and I mean, this is from my own compliance. Nothing I say is obviously advice or anything, and you know, we have to say these things. But I think initially I started investing about 12, 13 years ago, whenever the likes of, you know, your Terry Smiths and Nick Trains were coming up, and this idea of growth at a reasonable price was very big. So actually understanding what you were investing in was very, very important to me. And I remember speaking to Terry Smith, and he was talking about the likes of Unilever, and he said, you know, there might be a recession tomorrow, but you'll probably still wash your face. You know, these types of things were really, really inherent to when I was starting to invest. So I look at the way some people are investing now, and it is completely changing, because we now have a different zeitgeist of what's important in people's lives and what's really driving. Mm. So it was a blessing and a curse back then, because essentially I think it gave me a good understanding about understanding companies, what they're actually doing, right down to the very basis. And I actually personally, I avoided banks back then because I just couldn't understand them. Financials, certainly, you know, my first employer, the financials analysts were like the gods. They were like the most intelligent people, and they had to be, probably apart from fixed income, but we let them do their own thing. And it was about understanding exactly what you're investing in. So I went kind of from the growth-led model, and then kind of supplemented that. You know, James Thompson at Rathbones does a great job of incorporating tech, and it wasn't just about these old-school industries. And then I kind of graduated to thinking, okay, well, I'm a professional here. I should probably be choosing my own stocks.
Sure.
And I think that kind of leads you down the road of exploring down the FTSE a little bit. I'm a very big believer in supporting the FTSE. US companies are great, but we have very limited insight because we're not using the products, market cap scale. Yeah. But, you know, you can walk into Greg's, you can see the lines outside of it in London Bridge Station. You know, that means a lot.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely it does. So what year was it roughly that you perhaps did your own, made your own decision and took that first buy yourself?
Probably, I mean, I've been investing for about 13 years. So 13 years I went into funds, and then probably about 10 years ago, probably went into single stocks.
About 10, yeah. Okay, that makes sense. And were you around in that sort of 2008 period? I know me and Dan were talking about this the other day, and I think we were both at university, so we were really insulated really from any problems of that. But I thought it was funny when you said about that quote about you can probably still wash your face. I do actually remember watching the news, and BBC had interviewed someone, and he said, yeah, it's really bad, it's terrible, there's going to be a lot of fallout, but if you fell in love today, it doesn't really matter. that sort of stuck with me, because it does affect everyone, but it's almost like, it's very difficult, like it's so alien, isn't it? I think investing money to most people, it doesn't really come into your everyday life, but yet it does. And when things go wrong or good, it does affect you. It's almost a little bit intangible. And it's just an interesting sort of concept. I think everyone should be considering investing. You've got to do your own research, as you say, understand what it is you're putting your money into. But it affects everyone's everyday life. Mm-hmm. I mean, are you seeing at Robinhood a rise in, let's say, the more the retail, the normal people, the people with everyday jobs who perhaps like the idea of investing or are feeling stuck and want to try and improve their success? What are you seeing on the ground with perhaps the younger generation today?
Yeah. It's a really good point. And actually, do you know, that's really bad. I can't remember the years I went to uni, but I do remember the fact that I grew up in kind of the specter of the financial crisis. And it was affecting everything. It was affecting absolutely everything. And everyone just started pulling in the purse strings. It really hit everyone hard. And I think, I mean, I'm 36, But I think that it's probably a reason why a lot of people will just shut down when it comes to moving money from cash and taking that, crossing that boundary and climbing up the risk ladder slightly into investing. What we're finding is, you know, a lot of people come to Robinhood or are first-time investors. This is that they like the app, they like that it's, you know, it's slick and it makes it easy. It's not condescending and it's not tricky. You're not confronted with, you know, kind of, you know, charts and linear regressions as soon as you log in. It's the companies that you know, and it offers you a way to get involved. The barriers that we find that people have is one is really that the concept of risk. It's actually really odd. We did some research earlier in the year, and it was actually the framing of risk that seemed to be putting people off. They were very comfortable with the concept, and actually, once people were saying, "Yeah, we understand what risk is. We understand that we can lose money. We're seeing it on tube ads every 5 seconds," but it was about that word, and we never actually go into what that means and about how, you know, a positive risk taking attitude can actually start to hopefully make you money over the long term in equities. So I think we're really doing a lot of work on our Learn site. We have a full Learn suite of education.
That's good.
Materials to try and help just rid those myths around what risk and volatility actually are. And then the second thing is, I think you maybe touched on it there, that investing is just not for people like me. Mm. And that's a real barrier. And we actually find in the same bit of research we did, it's on our site, that people thought that you needed around, I think it's upwards of £2,000 to open a Stocks and Shares ISA. I mean, platforms are starting from as little as, you know, a pound or a dollar or £25 for something like that. But that's an industry problem, right? That's something that we have to correct. And realistically, it's something that we find as Robinhood that there's still place for us to contribute to this marketplace in the UK and let people know that you don't have to pay £10-11 every time you trade and then £10-11 when you trade out again. And you can also set this up in a way that it's handy for you. It's not in an open cold room with someone smoking a cigar and red braces. You can actually just take control of your own personal finance. And that's really what it is. And contrary to a lot of the media beliefs around young people not really caring, I think sometimes young people are a little bit despondent. But then whenever they actually care, we find a lot of people are really concerned about their own retirement and funding that later life.
Okay.
We're finding a lot, and we're trying to educate a lot of people, but we're also unearthing a lot of mistruths along the way.
So do you think, as well as the industry maybe having to do a bit more, there's also a education gap at schools, like really going back to when people are young and not being taught about how to manage their money once they go out into the adult world?
Oh, completely. And I feel like I have a little, I can be trusted to have an opinion here. I was a teacher for years. Yeah. For a few years. And I'll stick up for teachers here because teachers aren't equipped. Teachers are, you know, overworked and saying, hey, can you just chuck in a lesson on compound interest during form time or something? It's not going to happen. Yeah. And the way that it's been done in maths, that's up to the maths teacher. And then suddenly the curriculum has a question on a GCSE paper about gas meters. And then suddenly that's the financial side covered. Yeah. It is getting better. Still not great. But if we look to the likes of, you know, some of the Nordic states have really, really good models of financial education. People come out of school understanding mortgages. I came out of school understanding triangles really, really well and light inexpensible springs. But I hadn't a clue what a variable rate mortgage was. I really didn't. It's a little bit of a partnership there. And if you equip teachers or, you know, you make it part of the curriculum that actually these things that have later life skills are important early on, then it should be the first thing that you learn in school.
Yeah. I think it also needs to be taught in the right way as well. Because I look back and think of when I'm 15, I think if someone tried to tell me about pensions or investing, it would have just gone in one ear and out the other. But, you know, if you do it in an engaging way and tell them the same thing a few times, then perhaps it instills a little seed of, to focus on these things and that they're important when you do go out there.
Yeah.
interesting. Yeah.
Well, I mean, listen, the amount of stuff that's drilled into you at school, even though you don't want to learn it, we could probably just introduce this, even if it was pretty harsh.
Yeah,
that's true. That's true. I remember my financial education at school consisted of a couple of lessons about how to write a check, which still was relevant at that time. But, you know, it was obviously being phased out. But that's all I remember. But we should definitely in the UK introduce that, because it's money and finances. What makes the world go round, effectively, isn't it? It affects you in everyday life. And as young people, as children, you don't understand it. You don't need to understand it, because your parents presumably look after all of that for you. But it is important that it's in school so that people can get that understanding. And compound interest is a fascinating concept, and that should be taught in schools. I remember my first insight into compound interest was actually through, I worked for my dad for 10 years and he was run a training company. And one of the courses he did was presentation skills, where someone had to do a presentation, and then there was feedback given, and there was a 3-day course, and then you'd do a presentation again, hopefully better. But anyway, one of the guys on this course did a presentation on compound interest. And his opening slide was like, do you want £1 million by the time you retire? This is how to do it. And it was just a pound, starting from £1, and how that compounds. And it's a fascinating concept that everyone should understand, because, yeah, the power of that, and the biggest wealth-building tool that anyone has is their income. So putting it away and letting it compound over many years. And it's also having that long viewpoint, isn't it? There's a lot of, and I'm guilty of this, or I was guilty of this, you want that kind of faster return, because, you know, you need, when you're young, you need money now. When you're 60, hopefully you don't need it as much, because you've gone through life, your children have grown up, and you've hopefully put some money away. But you want it now when you're young, but it's very difficult to sort of have that longer life time plan. And it's interesting what you said, I think, about like the FTSE, for example, or some of the funds, of the big index funds. Isn't it right? I'm just taking the S&P 500, which is obviously in the United States, that over its whole all history, it's sort of generated about 10% annually, despite number of crashes along the way. So if you're holding it for the long term, you don't need to worry. So you don't need to speculate on individual stocks. You know, you can start sticking some money away into the S&P 500, the FTSE, for example. And generally speaking, you hold that for long enough over your lifetime, it will compound very nicely.
Oh, yeah. It's, I mean, I think in the long term, I mean, it's never guaranteed, but I think you're right. It is around 9-10. The FTSE is probably just slightly lower, but I mean, you look at what you're actually doing. You know, you're putting money into the companies that are relevant and funding and allowing you to live your life. Especially if you look at like the FTSE 250, these are domestically focused companies, most of them, that make a large portion of their cash domestically, that you can see and use and experience every day. So that's the range of companies that you're putting money into. And there's some crazy stat around, I can't remember the time frame, but the FTSE 250 outpacing the NASDAQ. There is an idea of, and I think that's around over a 20-year period or something. But this idea of investing into an index feels like this crazy product. Well, it's not a crazy product. You're investing in the lifestyle that you're living and the things that are relevant to you. So it doesn't have to just be this crazy product. And I think the industry is a little bit guilty of, you know, some of the fund names are amazing. You know, the growth in a reasonable price, FAC, institutional fund. You don't know what you're looking at, especially when I look at some pension statements and the name runs off into paragraphs. So there's an education point there. There's also an education point around, this isn't penalizing yourself. I think that's certainly the way I was taught about money, maybe from my parents, was don't do this now so you can have it later. And that's a good message. Mm. But it also feels like penalize yourself now, don't have something, and then at some point maybe you'll get something else. And it's not penalizing, you're actually helping yourself. You know, that's the message. Mm. Which is why I have a problem, and we're going to come up to tax year end, and undoubtedly we're going to see the articles on don't buy your coffee and put that into your tax efficient account instead. I have such a problem with that, because it's about the message is, in order to succeed, you need to penalize and be unhappy now. And that's just not the case. No. Good investing is about factoring it into your long-term goals, your attitude to risk, and your ability to save right now. And as soon as you get that right and you're happy with that, as you say, The history shows us that compounding takes care of itself.
Yeah. Does that mean I'm allowed to have avocado on toast then?
Like, well, now you've just placed yourself in a generation there.
Yeah, you have, Dan. Yeah, you have. So when it comes to Robin Hood, then, what are you seeing at the moment in terms of, let's say, sort of key market trends? Or, and again, I know we're not giving investment advice, but so I don't know what you can say on perhaps retail investors should or could be watching now. I mean, the obvious thing that's taking a lot of money from our point of view is tech. And I would also include crypto in that. So I'm talking Nvidia, I'm talking AI, talking obviously the cryptocurrencies. On Stockbox here, we talked a lot of mining companies. As you know, London's very heavy on mining. But there was a slide I saw recently where I think the market cap of Nvidia encompassed all of the mining companies in the world. So Nvidia was worth more than all of the mining companies. And to me, that's like a warning sign. You know, it's like there's too much money in tech. It'll probably start to rotate around. But first of all, what are you seeing at Robinhood? And anything that investors, perhaps should be looking at a bit more at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, every month we do an article on the most popular stocks that have been bought during the past month. And invariably, it is tech. You know, the tech is, it leads up that table. What I would say is, I mean, people can talk about AI bubbles if they want. I'm not going to opine on that. There's a lot more intelligent people, and even they get it wrong. So what we see from our trends is that tech's popular not because there's some pie in the sky hopes about the future, but because younger generations are seeing these companies as utilities. These aren't just fancy tech things that are going to change the world. People are using these. These are intrinsic parts of everyday life. So, you know, when you think about that, if you look at it through that lens and you think about, well, younger people are, you know, they're essentially stopping using Google and they're using ChatGPT now. What does that mean for OpenAI as a utility rather than a tech company? You know, this starts to change how we think about these things. It used to be that your consumer staples were the things that we have just talked about, Unilever, that they were the fallback. They were the things that you could see and use and every day. Fast forward to now, and actually a lot of the tech is taking that place in people's minds. That doesn't account for valuation arguments, and we could maybe talk about that a little bit more. Valuations are very high, but earnings seem to be backing those up. But again, when we think about the kind of that gap between what you've just talked about, like the mining companies, a lot of the time when we see things like, you know, the big miners are shoved around by global trade, a lot of people are watching those news headlines specifically now, and you're thinking about the US-China trade. Those big miners are getting shoved around, you know, week to week. So the volatility in them is very difficult to predict, whereas a lot of people are looking at the tech trade and saying, well, this is a multi-year trade, actually. And as long as these companies keep making money, ironically, it feels less volatile than some of the mining stocks.
Mm. Is that sustainable, though? Or, I mean, you mentioned valuations are high. Do you think that we are sort of climbing a wall of worry a little bit here and could be heading into dark times?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, when are we not? Really, realistically, yeah. there's doom mongers, and it just takes one person to point to the valuation arguments. What I would just remind people is that, you know, people point to the valuation discount that, you know, the US, I haven't looked at it in a while, but it's probably in the low 20s, and the UK is probably in the, you know, 12, 13, something around there. People look to that discount and say, well, hang on, why are we not buying UK stocks? Well, the index is a lot different. You know, we've got around 4% tech, they've got around 34% tech. That's not indicative of what the market is and where the market leaders are. I think a good argument for diversification was made around November, heading into this year. We saw a lot of flows out of the US into European assets specifically, because we had that, you know, the start of getting fears around US valuations, and then the deep moment in kind of Jan-Feb. Really started to capitulate some trades and move them into Europe. We're still seeing that appetite for Europe, but we're also seeing that spread into emerging markets. If you look at the Korean indices and SK Hynix and Samsung doing very, very well, arguably for me, just surveying young investors, it's not a bad thing to be seeing this money spread out across the world, across asset classes, across sectors. It's not a bad thing. And even if people aren't doing it consciously, that diversification away from the concentration in US tech isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah. I think generally sort of diversification or, you know, spreading your risk is a wise thing to do. I don't know. I think it, there's like a rule of thumb, and it's very difficult to get to it, but it's something like 25% of your net worth in property in bricks and mortar, 25% in precious metals, i.e. gold, 25 in cash, and then sort of 25 to put in the stock market. Now, I think I read that somewhere. It's a very crude rule of thumb, and it's obviously very difficult to get that balance exactly right. But if you can try and spread your wealth across these things, so don't go all in Bitcoin, for example, or all in on Nvidia because it's hot. You want to perhaps try and split that and maybe buy a gold sovereign or put something away to try and get a house or something like that. And also keep cash because, you know, cash, although inflation is eroding that value generally, if there is a problem, cash is where everyone goes to and cash is where you want to be. That's what's going to, you know, give you your meal that night, isn't it? You know, so... I think diversification is also very important. With Robinhood, can people do that? Can they diversify? I mean, is it just UK? Can they get into Europe? Can they get into the United States? Can they get into precious metals as well as tech? And yeah, what's the sort of scope within Robinhood for retail?
Well, at the minute in the UK, we have a huge suite of US stocks, and that's essentially because you know when we moved over, it was what our base knew us for and what they kind of wanted from us. So they've got a huge suite there. It's funny, we talk to UK investors and they ask for a lot of things, but actually the appetite tends to be for the same sort of names. I mean, we're very young in the UK and we are continuing to expand. And, you know, our CEO has been in the press and talked about our plans for the future. So it might go beyond that, but at the minute, the U.S. stocks is what the draw was. And I look at our top 10 buys, our most popular buys every month, and it just seems to be those similar names. The odd month, we would have things like health tech creeping in. We had two names in rare earth metals creeping in this month. And I think that's kind of, you know, a little bit of news watching. And what I would say is a lot of our investors are new and young, but they are so engaged and they're keeping up to date with the market in a way that even if you and I had wanted to 10 years ago, we couldn't have, you know, and we have things in our app. We have a Cortex Digests product, which, as it says, it digests what's happening in the market and serves it up to you in a little blurb just to help you understand what's happening during the day. I would have loved that whenever I started investing. I would have loved someone to summarize an earnings report. My word, especially with the likes of Shell and BP, that was a mission. But they're using tools. They've got the assets and they've got the appetite.
Do you think it's a bit of a disservice to young people to suggest they're just interested in crypto and things like that? Then that what you're seeing is that they're actively engaged in anything as long as it's relevant and looks like it's going to provide an interesting opportunity.
Yeah, I think it's unfair. I have to say it's unfair. I think the idea of I'm making an action now, so I need a response now, is so prevalent in so many parts of our lives that for young people, they could be forgiven for wanting to do that. You talked about making a quick buck. Everything else in our lives now is geared towards action and response. So they're actually doing very, very well to not go down that path and actually think about the long term. And to think about, okay, well, earnings are coming up. What do I need to consider? And then checking on the app for things like their earnings reports, the digest. Okay, well, what does this mean? What is the market saying? What's Robinhood telling me about this? So I think, to be honest, listen, if it was me, I don't think I'd be worrying about what the wider world was saying about me, because they said that about our generation as well, that, well, we were nonsense. We didn't know what we were doing. Just buy a house. So I don't think they really care, but it is the wrong opinion.
Good stuff.
Yeah, okay. I like the fact that you've got that on the Robinhood app and website there, that education piece and digesting, because that, is really important. I mean, back in the day, it was before I was doing it, but it was Teletext, I think, and the Financial Times, where you'd try even just get a stock price. You know, now it's every second, isn't it? It ticks. I don't know if you can you name any. Oh, you said there's like the top 10. Are you happy to sort of name what's trending right now, or is that?
Well, I mean, I can talk you through some of the names that have appeared there because I write about it every month and it's on.
It'll be interesting
for anyone to see. So some of the popular names have been, and obviously this is no guide to what would happen in the future and no advice. But the names tend to be your Teslas, your Nvidia, basically Mag 7 in there.
Right.
Some of the crypto miners, Mara tends to be quite big. And a lot of these miners that are changing from pure mining going into AI infrastructure as well. So things like Iron, CleanSpark is another one that tends to be in and around the list. But realistically, it is all tech. It's and even when I talk about health tech, it's those companies that are providing healthcare kind of infrastructure rather than the healthcare themselves.
Mm-hmm. And do you have an opinion on how leaders of these companies, the CEOs, for example, are engaging with your consumer, your retail people, and not kind of just the big boys? Because if young people are putting their money away, which it does seem like there's more and more of that happening now, then really that they're a key target audience, aren't they, for the CEOs to engage with?
Yeah. I completely agree, and it's part of the reason why, you know, on our site we write conversationally. You know, in previous roles, I've had to include as much Latin as I can to make myself sound smart or to satisfy institutional investors. Or this has to be 10 pages. Why? Well, it just has to be 10 because 10 sounds, you know, enough. Whereas everything on our site is quick, snappy snippets in conversational language. And that's how we want to get across. And the reason I say that is because it's exactly the same as when our CEO does his own earnings calls. We're a great believer in talking to people the way they want to be spoken to. So our CEO Vlad, he's great. He sits down. It's kind of like a post NBA conference, and he sits at the table and talks just openly about earnings and things. So that's one way, that open engagement with your investors, and not just barking from the pulpit, and also about as we start to question how often companies should be reporting. Sometimes, you know, certain sectors have they feel the responsibility to come up with something new and to start speaking about a new project, when actually you just need to talk to your investors about your long-term plans. Are your revenues stable? Is everything going to plan? Mm-hmm. Let's not confuse things. And certainly as we get to the point in the cycle where maybe growth is going to be slightly harder to come by, we just need to really make sure that our CEOs are telling us about those concrete plans, and there's no kind of the acquisitions coming in, or there's no, you know, what I want from my CEOs is a clear line on how you are using capital. That's all I really want from you.
Anything else
can be bluster.
I completely agree with that. I wish people would talk straight just a bit more. You know, I think we've got into this world of politicians, you know, where they don't give an answer, do they? But I think people are moving so far away from that. Even the mainstream media, people know that it's like, it's a narrative, you know? And it's a difficulty that I think, perhaps we do stuff from as well. You know, we are a corporate identity stock box, but, you know, we are individuals as well. We're not sort of YouTubers, you know, who have got the sort of, that kind of honest, I'm not saying we're not honest, but, you know, the kind of individual tends to get a bit more credibility, I think, these days than the mainstream, which is just a problem with what's been happening over generations of the message that's been coming and the language that's been coming from these organizations and politicians. And I wish that CEOs that we interview would just talk straight sometimes. And I think sometimes it's maybe regulatory issues as well, that, you know, they've got a regulatory environment, obviously, in London, which is different from Australia, for example. If companies are looking to raise money in Australia or North America, it can be openly talked about, you know, and investors are welcome to join in. There's tax incentives, whereas in London, it's like this unspoken thing. You can never talk about raising money because of fear of the market just destroying your value because they know you're going to raise money. It is a problem. I think London perhaps does need to catch up with perhaps the way Australia does things with that regulation. I just wish it was. I often interview people and you just think, just tell me as it is, you know, people will get it. You know, you don't need to kind of hide behind things. I don't know. Dan, you probably feel similar. I don't know. You speak to a lot of people.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree with both of you. I think simple, especially in this day and age, simple is definitely better, isn't it? I thought it's funny, Dan, what you're saying about as a writer by background, when people give you, it's like it should be 10 pages. There's no reason. It should. That feels like a length that will lend it legitimacy.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be like that, does it?
There's also, I mean, I go back to the whenever I was interviewing those fund managers. In my first year, I was thinking, what am I doing here? I don't understand any of the complicated stuff they're saying. 5 years in, you go, well, neither do they, actually.
Yeah.
They're just covering this. You know, they're making their job quite a bit more complicated than it needs to be.
Yeah. No, it's good. We should move down that route. I know when I read research notes, and Dan, you'll know this as well, they are like 10, I've read one that was like 30 pages, you know, once.
Yeah.
And really, the front page is what you want to know as a normal person. What's the target price? Where is it now? And kind of why? That's all you really need. And I tried to break down this 30-page document. It took me about 15 minutes on a video to do it, which I think I did an all right job. But really, let's just stick with that one pager. You know, let's give it to us straight, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know why those need to be 30 pages. There's a lot of disclaimers at the back that take up about half of it. And yeah, I agree with you. I think the first page is you can get everything you need, can't you?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of investment consultants and bank sell side analysts who could tell us why it needs to be. But
yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm sure. It's interesting, and I want to come on to a point about miners, but not crypto miners, actual miners in the ground, because you mentioned rare earths, and I've always liked rare earths, and I said sort of a few years ago that word rare earth elements will be on the lips of many, many people in the future, and here we are today, and it's starting to happen, isn't it, you know, with the headlines coming in. London, as you know, is very mining heavy. I think you've also held stocks in mining companies yourself, and the sector is very cyclical. We know that it goes through a sort of a huge boom and then basically a huge bust cycle. And it's sort of been in the doldrums for quite a while. The last time it came out was after 2008. After that crash, after things consolidated, after government said, right, we need to build a way out of this, then the miners started to go. It'll probably happen something similar because you know, you can always say this time is different, but it rarely is. But when it comes to like hard assets, you know, commodities, copper, gold, silver, zinc, lead, all the commodities. Are you seeing much interest from people on your platform in that sector? Obviously, you said rare earths was attracting some interest. And perhaps do you think investors should be looking at that a bit more? Because you cannot deny the value of something hard. You know, crypto, I know, has a value, but you can't touch it. You know, it's not really real, but it does have a value. Whereas hard assets do. And they are in finite supply and they are used in real world. So do you think it should be something that people consider as part of their portfolio? And are you seeing any newer interest in that sector coming in?
You're right that it does seem like it's worlds away from kind of the tech scene. I was going to say unfortunately. It's not really unfortunately. It's just a phenomenon that a lot of people who grew up and who are investing for the first time now, have never really heard about these companies. And the only thing that they've heard about them is, you know, the likes of disasters in mines or oil spills or ESG, which was, I think everyone agrees that ESG is important. How it's been administered has been, you know, it's been to various degrees successful. But there was a massive drive for ESG assets, and that's kind of waned now. Certainly I remember, you know, writing a lot about Sector 9 funds, and you weren't allowed to use Sector 9 as a label because, you know, that was not a selling point. That was just a label that you were ESG compliant. And then the whole industry used Sector 9 as a label that, you know, we're fine, we're clean. So it started, the ESG scene started to get a little bit cynical. But what that left us with was anything mining bad and anything tech that's acceptable. And you know, whether people want to or not, or they're doing it willingly, we're overlooking the fact that a lot of these rare earths are allowing those tech companies to exist. And it's just a part of the supply chain that people don't really want to talk about. Certainly on the institutional side, things like mineral companies, it's very difficult to put into an investor deck and say that we're standing behind this because your investors have ESG responsibilities, and they can't hold certain things. That does flow into retail. That does, because when we start to talk about fueling further innovation, institutional flows kind of lead the way. So I know we're talking about retail appetite. Institutional flows are leading that in when we think about the creation of like Bitcoin ETNs and things like that.
Yeah.
Coming back to the point of mining just hasn't been popular. It's been really out of vogue. People think it's kind of negative or bad when really it does allow a lot of the industries that we use today to exist. Think about what's in your smartphone. A lot of that can't exist without those miners. I think that the challenge is when we look at the UK mining sector and we look down the cap scale, a lot of artisanal miners have such volatility and such high spreads that it's very difficult to bring in an investor who won't get scared off. A lot of those small artisanal miners are also, I mean, they're in the exploratory stage, but it's also difficult to say to an investor, this might fully come off or this might fully not. There's rarely somewhere in the middle for these plays. Mm-hmm. And then as you rise up, you get into the big names that are often tarred with a fairly negative news brush.
I think you're totally right. I think that binary sort of approach isn't for everyone, is it? And when you put that with the ESG, it does create quite a niche sort of investor base. But like you say, these metals and these minerals that are being mined are absolutely essential to everything. They're used in everything that we use in our day-to-day life. And perhaps it's down to the industry itself, the mining industry, to create a greater awareness of that and say, mining isn't just this bad thing that we, you know, people do just to make money. It makes the world go round. And, you know, if you want that to continue, then we do need these smaller exploration companies and artisanal miners to get the minerals out of the ground. So, yeah, obviously, Mark and I cover them a lot. We both invest in this space. I think there could be a lot more could be done to increase its appeal among mainstream investors, particularly moving forward as perhaps gold powers forward. More people are becoming interested in that. And perhaps as some capital cycles out of tech stocks and people are looking for the next big return opportunity, because I do think a lot of these exploration companies would fit their risk profile.
Mm. Well, I mean, there's things like, if we take a few case studies, I mean, if you look at the lithium market, that had a massive boom a few years ago, the price of kind of lithium spodumene concentrate is really quite low now compared to what it was. But if you look at an artisanal miner who can still make money off that low price, that's kind of a good area for some people to maybe be looking into, because you look at who the partners are, and more often than not, the partners are large Chinese corporations who want every scrap of lithium on the planet. But why do they want that? Okay, well, they want it to power the EV market. And suddenly it starts to make sense for people who know a little bit more about EVs. Especially when, you know, people who have explored clean energy, but, you know, there's been problems with some clean energy ETFs and some people have been scared off that. So the point about fueling the future isn't just about backing the big tech names. It is about looking down the whole supply chain. And sometimes those second order opportunities is where you find value misplacements as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, definitely mining investing is risky. It is very risky. None of them make any money. That's why they're on the markets, to raise money, to hopefully find something to make money. But yeah, it's a crazy statistic. I don't know, 98, 99 out of 100 will never actually go to production. And I think one thing that I have learned from mining investing is just don't get emotionally attached. Don't get too involved in the company. You've got to take a real, just pragmatic look at it. Don't think, oh yeah, this is great. I've been part of this story since grassroots and now it's going to become a huge mine. What a great feeling that is. Because it's very unlikely that'll happen. And how often have we seen it where people have made a lot of money and then lost it effectively? It's that traditional Lassonde, you can Google that, the Lassonde curve, you know, when the value is increased at, when drilling starts, a find is made, then reality sets in, and then off it goes again. And I think taking profits is really, 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 really important. And don't look at the share price, like look at the value of the company and where you came in at that company and where it is now. Gosh, if you must make 10%, doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a huge return. No way is a bank going to ever give you that. And some of these mining companies can return, you know, 50, 100, thousands of percentage. Unlikely, but you must just take your profit when it's there. Don't get married to it. Don't get greedy is another big thing, because that's a fault of humans, isn't it? We do get greedy. But I did like what some of the mining companies are actually trying to do. I think they're doing it in the States, but definitely in London, is they are sort of having this Bitcoin treasury policy. So they're sort of trying to, I think, attract some of that crypto tech money. And also AI, a lot of them using AI now with their exploration. I think that's a really good angle, because it could sort of marry what you would say digital assets with hard assets in the ground. So, yeah, if people want to consider perhaps a little bit of that, there are mining companies on there that have that digital strategy as well as the real hard assets. So it kind of offsets the risk a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the what I would say is look for genuine expertise in those areas. It does rhyme with times whenever you could add .com on anything and the share price went up, or you added coin on anything and it went up as well. So genuine expertise on the ground is the most important thing.
Absolutely, yeah. Credibility of the people, that's really important. That's what I like to look at when I'm looking at these companies. And I think a lot of the miners are now looking at the low hanging fruit. So a lot of them are looking at getting into just like easy cash flow or quick wins, just to get some cash coming in, you know, so they can make some little bit of money and then look to actually go for the bigger wins. Mm-hmm. I wonder if we can perhaps just finish off, perhaps just thinking about, we're nearly at the end of 2025, but if we perhaps sort of look forward, maybe sort of the outlook for the UK and global markets through sort of 2026. You did mention about institutions move first. I don't know if you have any insights on where the flows are going at the moment, but if we can finish off with perhaps just some thoughts for, yeah, the next year, I think that would be great.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, no real insight on the flows just yet on the institutional side. Right. I give up those terminals whenever I left the hedge fund. In terms of what we see in the UK, I mean, we've still got these hopes for rates. It's all going to depend on the budget. And to be honest, we actually chatted before we came on here. Your guess is as good as mine when it comes to what's going to come out of the budget. As long as we have inflation under control, we could start to see a little bit more life creeping into the UK mid caps. It's not a sure thing, but they are the ones in the UK small caps. They're the ones that do naturally better out of rates coming down, because they have such, you know, they have bigger, I'm not going to say such high rates, they just have more floating rate interest, right? So then there's a bit more hope for them in 2026. That sounds like I'm tipping every single small and mid cap. I'm absolutely not. But there would be a little bit more of a supportive environment there. The tech trade, I think, is important. We need to kind of measure those valuations. We actually have had this in the past, though, where valuation arguments are sparking bubble talk, and then suddenly something else distracts and we all forget about it.
Yeah.
The big point is, are these companies backing up those valuations by consistent earnings? That is the real point. That's what separates all of this from talk around any other period in history. Dot-com boom, whatever. These earnings are coming through. One thing on my mind is the fact that the market starts to become so fickle, because even whenever you beat earnings, it's not by beating it by enough of what it really wanted you to beat it by. So we saw that actually this time last year with NVIDIA. Yes, it topped its quarterly, but actually analysts had this kind of secondary target in their head and it didn't quite hit that. So the stock went down. And that starts to raise a few questions about what are the actual target prices here? And when are people willing to say, you know, I've made my money there? And to be perfectly honest, in institutional circles, no one's going to fire me for selling NVIDIA right now, because of look what I can show. And what is the incremental gain, and is it worth my career? And that's where you start to think about career risk in institutional circles. I feel like for retail, looking around them, seeing what the world is like, looking at what their pay packets look like and the cost of living is so, so important. Because Whereas kind of corporate and institutional research will go into finding out about the state of the consumer in 2026. We are the consumer in 2026. So we'll be able to see how any changes to tax, any changes to what we're allowed to invest in and where we can put it and everything. We will be the ones to see that first because we're actually on the ground doing it. It's research that people pay a lot of money for and we get it for free. So we have to trust what we're seeing as well. But yeah, that rate trajectory, especially in the UK, is going to be very important.
Absolutely. And you're right, we won't know what that is until it comes out. But it's soon, isn't it? Is it next month? Is it November, I think?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's quite soon, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I'll just finish with a thought on bubbles. I mean, yeah, you can argue all day that we're in a bubble, but no one ever knows when it's going to burst and no one ever knows how deep it's going to be. And, you know, there were calls of bubbles, I think, during the dot-com and it continued going for quite a few years before it actually did burst. And I can't remember, was it Isaac Newton got caught up in a bubble? Was it Isaac Newton, the South Sea bubble?
Yes, with
where he made some money and he got out very happy with himself, but it continued going and all his mates were making loads of money. So he capitulated and went in. Yeah. Right at the peak and lost all of it, I think.
Yeah, so, not Isaac Newton, you know. So we have to be better than one of the smartest men in history.
Exactly.
Easy.
Yeah.
Easy.
Well, thank you very much, Dan Lane, for your time today. It's been really great to talk to you. Thank you very much for joining us from Robinhood. I hope we can perhaps catch up again. Maybe we can do this sort of semi-regularly and get your insights. I've really enjoyed it today.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on. Really appreciate it. And hopefully it's not the last one.
Excellent. Well, thank you for your time.
Cheers, guys.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.